The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
There's a curious phenomena that can happen in meditation. That happens, I think, generally when the mind is quite concentrated and still. And so still that there might be virtually no thoughts and no thinking going on for periods of time. And the mindfulness is quite sharp. So you're very present for what's going on. Really there, right there, watching things happen as they happen. And and some people report it like this. It's like you feel or sense something that feels like the arising of a bubble in the mind. And that bubble, that arising of kind of like some pressure or like a bubble, is the beginning of a thought. So it isn't that you're thinking yet, but you feel the thought beginning. But because you're right there, and you're right present for that bubbling up of the thought, it dissipates. Now the curious thing about this is that you then never know what that thought was going to be about. So what was that thought going to be? Maybe it was the great American novel. It was the answer to the riddle of the universe. Maybe all your life's problems. The lottery number. You know, what was that thought going to be? And but what I find most curious about it, remarkable, is that it clearly feels like the beginning of a thought. You know, if you let it go, it would develop into a thought. So where does that thinking begin? Chances are it was a particular thought that you were going to have. But you're not conscious of it. You're not conscious of the genesis of it, the beginning of it, and what it arises out of. You wouldn't be aware of what you were going to think until after the bubble burst, came out. But what was going on that you were not conscious of, that you're not aware of? What was going on there? Something had to be going on for that to kind of give birth to that thought. So that's the topic I'm interested in this evening, is what is it that's going on here for us that we're not conscious about, that we're not aware? And it's a great topic, and it's a topic that covers so many different dimensions of who we are, so many different levels of what we're not conscious of. But you know, what is it that you're not conscious of? What are you not aware of about how you operate? What makes you operate the way you are? The choices you make? And part of the function of mindfulness is to have us look more carefully so we can start seeing what has previously been not conscious and let it come into consciousness and into awareness. So we can see the choices we make, the decisions we make, the what's operating behind what we do. So, I mean, one of the great places to see that is in conversation. If you spend some time really honestly looking at why you're going to say what you're going to say when you say it, you probably don't need to do a spiritual practice anymore. Because probably everything gets revealed about you that you need to know. There's a lot, social conversation is not just exchanging of matter-of-fact information. The train station in Redwood City is called the Sequoia Station. I mean, occasionally we might say that, but, there's usually much more going on than just information. We're conveying a lot about our relationship to other people, our desires, our wants, our values. Our understanding of what it means to be in community with other people. There's a tremendous amount of background, cultural, personal, familial background that goes behind acts of speech. And so I've caught myself, after I've said it, wondering, why did I say that? And then I realized I said it because I was trying to make an impression. I was trying to have the person see me in a way that I hoped they would see me. I was trying to create an impression in order to feel safe or not judged or not criticized or, you know, something. And so I wasn't just giving information, I was kind of trying to shape the person's view of who I am by what I said. And, you know, the remarkable is that I didn't see it until after I'd done it. Then look back, wow, look at that. There are sometimes I can see it about to happen, and then I can choose whether it's useful to do or not. But how many times do we go about our speech not paying careful attention to the what is it that's prompting us to say what we're going to say? Some of us have had the experience of saying things we later regretted. And we say, what was I thinking? And usually we say, well, I guess I wasn't thinking at all. But you were thinking something, that bubble there in the background. There's a lot going on. There's a lot of processing, a lot of information, a lot of values, a lot of things going on. And so what is that? What do you carry with you that you're not usually aware of and conscious of? In our Buddhist tradition, there's a term called anusaya. It's the Pali word, Buddhist word, anusaya. And it's usually translated into English as latent tendencies. Proclivities. I have trouble sometimes with words that I've never said before but only read. Proclivities. But latent tendencies. And what's interesting about the word latent is that they're just laying there waiting for a time to be activated, to be triggered. So one of the classic examples of something like this would be someone who's maybe been on a long retreat, someone who's been maybe monastic, monk or nun, and I mean the classic example is in Thailand of people go off into to be monk or nun, these beautiful forest monasteries, or not so beautiful forest monasteries, that exist. And they're off way off into the kind of the boonies. It's very quiet and relatively peaceful. And they're living a very simple life. People are bringing them foods. They don't have to cook for themselves. They don't have to do anything for their livelihood. They just get to sit around and meditate a lot. Sometimes in Thailand, the monastics are adored by the laity. And so you kind of feel like you're kind of special, right? And so there are a lot of good conditions there. And so there's plenty of people who have gone there to be monastics and done long retreats and gotten pretty concentrated, pretty still, kind of forgotten all their concerns, you know, dropped away a lot of their things, and then sitting there kind of so contented and happy and say, I think I must be enlightened. Or I think I must be pretty advanced. This is pretty good. Now I can just enjoy my enlightened retirement. And then, maybe they have to get a new visa, maybe, to go to, stay in Thailand for these Westerners. So they have to take the train down to Bangkok. And now Bangkok is a whole different place than, you know, off there in the woods. And traffic and noise and people. And then they find themselves getting irritated or upset or impatient or you know, all kinds of things. And then to wait a minute, I thought I was, you know, on the brink of enlightenment. And now I wonder, you know, now I'm kind of, you know, now I'm really challenged by all this. So, you know, there might be these beautiful people you see, and so you suddenly all this lust arises. You know, for a year up in the monastery, there was no lust at all, but suddenly, whew, you know, I thought I was free of lust forever. I'm just going to sit in the cloud. And then suddenly there's objects of lust appear, and so lust arises. Well, I guess I didn't free myself of my lust. And then, you know, you can't explain to the taxi driver where you want to go, and the taxi driver takes you to the other side of Bangkok, which happened to me once. Really other side. And so then you get angry. So, oh, there's the anger. I thought I was free of anger. And it goes on and on, or fear. You know, And so there's these forces for desire, for anger, for fear, and for a lot of what's called these latent tendencies, can be there quiet for a long time, just bidding their time, in a sense, until the conditions come together to trigger them. And so, so again, what are we not aware of? What are we not conscious of? We can not be aware of the latent, what's latent, what's in the, you know, not being triggered, because the conditions are such that those things don't get triggered. And not a few people who have, you know, been surprised by what, you know, they come to one conclusion, oh, this is great, and then find out that it's not so great after all, what, you know, they're not so wise or well-developed after all. I remember I had this once where I came to the wonderfully and glorious conclusion that now I'll never get depressed again. That was one summer. And that fall, I was more depressed than I'd ever been in my life. So, so one of the things I valued about the Zen training that I did was Zen training, it put you in a lot of different contexts for practice. And so it wasn't just a very pristine meditation monastery you can just sit and meditate for, you know, years on end, which you can do sometimes in Southeast Asia. The monasteries had you change your job, your work, your situations a lot, all the time. And so you got to see much more clearly sometimes what you're challenged, or what you're holding on to, or what your the latency was there. So, for example, one of the great experiences that was happened repeatedly, when I was a new monk at the Zen monastery, I was really into meditating. Like, that was where I was at, right? I mean, what else is important? Just, you know, meditate until something. And young and idealistic. And so I'd be sitting there meditating and feeling this is it, you know, if I just meditate enough, then something wonderful will happen. I'll get enlightened or something. And then I'd sit in the meditation hall, and then literally I'd feel this finger tapping me on my shoulder. Come with me. We need you to work in the kitchen now. One of the cooks is sick, and we need you in the kitchen. But I'm on the brink of... I'm just finally getting concentrated. We need you now in the kitchen. And so it was great because I got to see my attachment to my practice, you know, my concentration, my idealism, and I had a choice. Either I held on to the idealism, held on to those attachments, and resented the fact that I was in the kitchen of all places. That was one choice. Or it was let go of those attachments, let go of those expectations, and just go down to the kitchen, just be in the kitchen. Just be there fully. So I did that, and that happened for a while, and then, after a while, they assigned me permanently to the kitchen. Well, permanently was for a year. So that was a bit of a shock first. Wait a minute, I came to a Zen monastery to meditate, now I'm in the kitchen? And it was a great place to work. One of the reasons was there were all these latent tendencies I carried around with me that got triggered in the kitchen. And if I had stayed, you know, doing something else that was more... Zen kitchens are known to be pressure cookers. I don't know if kitchens, like commercial kitchens are that way or whatever, but there are all these people, a small amount of space with a tremendous amount of kind of pressure to get this food out and get it out well and all kinds of stuff, and it was quite intense. So in that situation, I got to see latent tendencies, and as I've told you, some of you here, I don't know how latent they were, but just I got to see things that I hadn't didn't know about myself until then. One of the things I saw was that I was neurotically attached to wanting people to like me. And it's okay to want people to like you, but it's not a bad thing in and of itself, but to be attached to it neurotically, I can tell you from my experience, it's very, very painful. And so I was made the kitchen kind of supervisor, which in a Zen monastery is the last place anybody's going to like you. You know, it's really hard because you're telling people what to do, and no, you can't cut it that small, and you have to cut it bigger or smaller or this or that. And, you have to tell people, you have to tell all these people, very sensitive people, about what they're doing. Remember one guy who told me that I need to talk to you outside, and one of the people in my crew, and he said, Gil, after once we were outside, he said, Gil, if you weren't so sincere, I'd punch you out. So, you know, I didn't succeed. I don't know, I only half succeeded in getting him to like me. I don't know what, you know. It wasn't a great success story. And so so I got to see the pain of my being attached to wanting people to like me. And it was something that was not tenable. I couldn't maintain it in that kind of environment. And so I had to see it right in my face in a way that I'd never had to see it earlier in my life. I never had to look at it. Somehow I succeeded okay in life. I kind of, you know, things weren't, you know, they weren't so intense socially or interpersonally in my life until that kitchen experience. And so the weak link in my person, in the way I function in the world, the weak link finally showed itself there. And so I had to come to terms with this wanting people to like me. It's easy, I think, to have things operating that are we're not so aware of, not conscious of. So in our tradition, which loves lists, there's seven anusayas, seven of these latent tendencies. And as you listen to them, I don't take them so, you know, I don't know if literally is the right word, but so like an absolute list. Someone a long time ago came up with these seven, and perhaps there are other ways of talking about them, other labels for the same thing, other angles to look at the same processing of phenomena going on. But it's interesting to consider them. So the first is the latent tendency to sensual desire. And, you could be quite content until for my kids, they can be quite content until you say the word ice cream. And then the desire is, like a force of nature. And so until certain conditions sometimes appear, we're not caught in the desire for sensual pleasure. But when conditions are there, then sometimes it can be very hard to put it down. People can obsess and be addicted to it even at times. And so some strategy of some people then is to withdraw from the context of where they're tempted. And sometimes that's a wise thing to do, but it could also make it so that people don't really confront themselves and really see what's going on here. Simply remove yourself from the problem might not help you deal with the latent tendencies. And those latent tendencies then just stay dormant. They stay in the background. Just is that our speakers?
Something new.
Or Twitter, or someone's phone maybe. Oh, isn't that pretty good? I had, my last cell phone had, I don't have it now, but the cell phone I had before, one of it had choice of having the ringtone be a rooster crowing. And especially when I was outdoors here in Redwood City, people would not have a clue it was a phone ringing. They thought maybe it was a neighborhood chicken or something. So the issue, if you simply remove yourself from where you're tempted, then the latent tendency will just stay there quiet for, a long time. And then you might be, and at some time when it's least convenient, it might rear its head again. So there's something to be said about not withdrawing from places of temptations, that ordinarily like happen, but to actually turn and look at it and come to terms with it, work through it, and try to come to a new understanding or become wise about it or learn how to let go of the attachments and clinging that might be related to these kinds of things. So the second latent tendency is ill will or anger or aversion or hatred. And so sometimes it could be a strong tendency to, to have that rear its head. And there's a story in the suttas of a maid who kind of had a sense of what was really going on for the woman she worked with. But everyone thought the woman she worked with was a saint, kind of just really always. And so she thought, well, I'm going to test her. And so she, this is back, 2,500 years ago, more like a slave perhaps than a maid. And so the maid was supposed to wake up early and get everything ready for the day. So she slept in. And so their mistress, got a little bit annoyed and said, you can't do that. And so, okay. So the next day she slept in again. So then she got angry. And the next day the maid slept in again. And then the mistress got really angry and started yelling and screaming and hit her over the head. And the maid ran out of the house with blood down her head and telling the neighbors, you see? The latent tendency was there. Even though the person seemed like a saint, when the conditions are right, many people can be saints. But when the conditions are not right, how are you? How are you in times of crisis? What comes forth out of you? Does fear, does anger, hostility, is that your response to a crisis? Or is it courage? Is it truthfulness? Is standing up and really facing it? The world is filled with wonderful examples of both. People who have succumbed in times of crisis to the worst that's inside of them, and ordinary, seemingly completely ordinary people who seem like anybody else ordinary, whatever that is. And in times of amazing crisis, became exemplars of something quite beautiful, and that was there latent. So what do you do? So the third latent tendency is what the tradition calls it views, opinions, stories, making up stories, making up opinions about how things are. So human beings are great storytellers, assigning meaning, finding meaning, interpreting things, making things be a certain way. A great story that I've told many times in this regard is Sylvia Borstein, another teacher, called up the San Francisco Zen Center. She wanted to be a guest there. They had a kind of guest rooms. And so she called up and they said, oh, you have to talk to Robert, the guest manager. He'll call you back. And so he called her back when she wasn't in. He left a message saying, it's Robert, call me back. So she called back Zen Center. And they said, in the office said, well, Robert's not in. And so Sylvia said to the office person, I think this means that I'm not supposed to come to Zen Center. And the office person said, no, I think what this means is that Robert's not in. So there can be a very strong tendency to want to make interpretations. And what's interesting about that is what goes into the story making, the meaning making, the interpretations we have. And there's where a whole other whole invisible world, background world, can exist of our past experiences, our memories, the stories of our life, what happened to us in the past. And we carry with us, and Buddhism talks about, we carry with us these seeds or these kind of impressions from our life experiences that are there informing us, creating habits, creating tendencies, creating predispositions to see certain ways, to interpret certain ways. And so we don't really necessarily see things as they actually are. We see it through the lens of these past conditioning, past impressions, past stories, past traumas, past challenges we have. I see it now with raising my children. I don't know how common this is for other parents, but I certainly see it in myself, that some of the challenges I had as a kid, I now read into my children. And I don't know if they're going through the same challenges, but I'm kind of tuned in, and looking at that and worried about them this way and that way. Oh, they're going to have the same thing. Oh, no. This is happening again, it's how much is it self-fulfilling prophecy? Because you're signaling it out, and I'm concerned about it. Maybe they kind of who knows how it affects their conditioning. So I can see my conditioning, and as a child it affects how I see my kids and my concern about them, and so I have to be very careful about this and make sure that I work through whatever is left over of my tenderness or uncertainties or whatever of my earlier conditioning. So it's a huge world behind the tendency to interpret, make stories, have views, is, you know, a whole big background that many of it, which can be very difficult to see, all the different things that feed into how we want to interpret or make stories or make meaning out of something. So the fourth is conceit. That's the usually word in English, is conceit. Mana. The whole thing of I am something, I am this, and I think we have a very strong tendency to form to have not only a sense of I am here, but then to add to that I am all kinds of appendages. I am this. I'm that. I'm not this. I'm not that. And it seems like an innocent enough, or sometimes it seems like an appropriate thing to do. It seems like, of course I am this way. But we build these layers of ideas, of stories, of opinions about what it means to be a self, building on the sense of conceit. And what Buddhism suggests is that conceit is a form of attachment, a form of freezing or tightening up or being or locking down around something, rather than being fluid and flexible with the environment and the situation. It doesn't mean we can't hold our ground, but we become very fragile if we kind of are holding on to a tight, fixed idea of who we need to be. So this kind of the thing of conceit. And then in terms of what I mentioned earlier about looking at your speech, you know, why you're going to say what you say, if you really look at that carefully, probably a lot of the motivations for what you're going to say are some one way or other are self-referential. Back to the conceit of I am or what I want or something. So that's so desire, ill will, views, conceit. Then there's there's doubt, being perplexed. So I'm not sure. I'm not sure exactly how that works, but as a latent tendency, but. That's what tradition suggests, is that we have a tendency to be confused about things or have doubt or have uncertainty. I guess uncertainty in the sense of uncertainty around choosing what to do, what's the right thing to do, and not being able to choose. And then the sixth one is very interesting, and this is, it's bhava raga in Pali. It's raga is a powerful word. It means like lust. So lust for becoming. In ordinary English, it's lust to exist. So not just simply wanting to exist, but the lust to exist. Very powerful. Maybe in colloquial English, maybe a better word is the drive to exist. And that's how they like to say it back in the ancient world. And thinking about it today, I was thinking maybe for us, maybe it's closely connected to the idea of wanting to be safe, to feel secure, to want to be, to live, you know, the desire to live, to be alive. It seems like an ordinary, healthy thing to want to live, right? But it can be neurotic. It can be something that's really, that holds us tight. In fact, my own real first impetus to study Buddhism when I was 20 was I recognized that I was afraid to die. And it wasn't okay. I felt that it was kind of a limitation because it was back in the time of the Vietnam War, And people were dying doing these nonviolent protests in the United States. And I wanted to be able to have the ability to stand up for my beliefs and be able to protest nonviolently. And I could feel that I was afraid of dying. And there was a limitation for me living my ideals. And so I was looking around for some way to come to terms with this fear I had, this attachment I had to life. Not that I wanted to die foolishly, but I also didn't want to kind of let my attachment to life stand in the way of living some deeper values that I felt were very important for me. And so somehow I landed on Buddhism, that Buddhist practice had practices, Buddhism had practices to help us directly deal with this issue of attachment to life, fear of death, things like that. And that's, that can be very powerful in some people. This, you can be very happily living your life, not thinking that you're attached to it, until you get, you know, the ultrasound back, CAT scan back or something. Uh-oh. So then, and the last of the latent tendencies in this list is ignorance, which Buddhism puts a great emphasis on ignorance, and it seems like, you know, I certainly feel like I'm mostly ignorant of a lot of things. Certainly my kids think so. But it's not ordinary not knowing. What it means is, I think of it as an ignoring, of not really seeing what is useful to look at. And so it's latent tendency of not really look honestly and completely at what's happening in the situation, to pretty it over, to make it look better than it actually is, or to ignore something. And the key thing that, at least in Buddhism, we say that defines ignorance is ignorance of suffering and ignorance of the cause of suffering. So the movement in Buddhism is, if you're suffering, is to turn and look at it and be honest about it. Stop and look at it. Not so you can suffer better, but rather so that you could resolve it, move beyond it. But there's a strong tendency to turn away from suffering, to ignore it, to distract oneself from it, to blame someone else for it, to do all kinds of things that are the ignoring of it, looking at it directly and honestly, looking at what we're doing, what our contribution is to it. So there can be a strong tendency not to want to look. And I've known people who, you know, have really shut down, turned away, walked away, run away, because they just don't want to look at what's going on. Sometimes it can be devastating for whole families when individuals, you know, don't want to stop and really look at what's, you know, the suffering that's there. So there's this list, so these latent tendencies. The Theravada tradition doesn't say much about the opposite. Or say this way, the opposite in terms of the latent tendencies which are beautiful. They talk about the latent tendencies which cause suffering, cause us to cling and get attached. But it doesn't talk a lot about the latent tendencies that might be more healthy or beautiful to have. But from my experience, or my sense, is that there is latent tendencies in many people, at least. I don't know if it's universal. Latent tendencies towards integrity, latent tendencies towards truthfulness, latent tendencies towards certain kind of wholeness or harmony or peace, latent tendencies towards love and compassion, to empathy. And the fact that these things are latent doesn't necessarily mean that they're causes of suffering. And one of the surprises for me has been in discovering and doing Buddhist practice what seems to have been latent before. I mean, seemingly, I don't know what was there before. I didn't know, right? But certainly there grew over time a much greater capacity for compassion, for integrity, for truthfulness. And in fact, for me, it's felt that it's those forces in me of integrity, of truthfulness, of love, which is really the fuel for wanting to go deeper into practice, for the unfolding of practice. And I didn't know that I had those when I was younger, but the practice itself revealed them, and as they revealed them, they became forces that helped further. So it's my belief that a lot of these latent forces can operate subconsciously. We don't know how they operate. And sometimes the people refer to them as instincts, as intuition. Sometimes people will have wonderful philosophies to justify why it's okay to be the way they are. I see people who will rather than looking at their hate and trying to find a different way of being, will justify their hate and create whole philosophies around why it's okay to hate. or philosophies of why it's okay to have desire and want certain things. And that people do the same thing with the beautiful qualities. They create philosophies around the importance of love or integrity and all that. But then we remember that one of the latent tendencies that causes suffering is views. And what happens if we drop our views? What happens if we don't operate through the filter of opinions, interpretations, and ideas? I think that's one of the wonderful challenges of this practice of mindfulness, is that we're asked to best we can, to drop stories, to drop interpretations, even good ones, even good Buddhist ones, in favor of two things, of looking really clearly what's there, and as we look more clearly what's here for ourselves, to start dropping the attachments or the veils or the resistance or the ways in which we're closed down, so we can really feel more fully, so we can be more sensitive, we can really kind of drop the ways in which we've frozen or gotten tight. And as we do this, well, I think what's very, again, I found very fascinating is we start becoming aware more and more of those forces within us, those motivations within us, those beliefs and thoughts and latent things that were not so evident when we went around living our busy life, active life. And so we could be starting to have access to some of these deeper sources of what makes us operate the way we do. Things don't stay not conscious, but they start coming into consciousness. And the whole process of going into vipassana, into meditation, is at times a process of bringing what's not conscious into consciousness. And unfortunately, fortunately, both, what often comes into consciousness is those things which are unresolved, the unresolved issues in our life. And so this is very important to realize, because some people have very idealistic idea about what meditation is, that it's only about being calm, peaceful, blissed out, riding on a cloud, equanimous about everything, and live happily ever after. But in fact, as we settle down and get quieter and more sensitive, more attentive to what's movements of the mind, what's going on, we start seeing things that we haven't been conscious of before. And it can get pretty interesting. Sometimes it's not good news, and sometimes it's better news you ever could have imagined of what you see in yourself. There's tremendous beauty in everybody's hearts, and it's a pity to leave it latent, isn't it? And so to let the beauty that's there come out and kind of be your gift to the world. And the path of doing this in mindfulness is a very simple path. It's just simply stopping in the present moment, or not stopping, but in the present moment, really recognizing, seeing, this is what's happening now. This is what's happening now. In meditation, it's kind of a preeminent place to do that. You slow down, get quiet, you're not so easily distracted, and you say, what's going on now? What am I seeing? What's happening? And you start seeing what's revealed, more and more of these, you know, the deeper structures of our mind, our consciousness, our mental processing, what's going on. Even better is to be on retreat. I mean, our particular tradition puts a lot of emphasis on meditation retreats, where there can be several days in a row of silence, of stillness, several days where you can kind of temporarily let go of the normal thoughts and concerns of your daily life. And then when the mind gets quieter, it gives you a chance to see the underlying structure, the deeper operating principles that are much more subtle and difficult to see in daily life, but which are the genesis for, you know, the cornerstone or the edifice of our behavior and our thoughts and our beliefs. And so we could get down to kind of what our tradition says is it calls it the roots, not the cornerstones, but the roots. And so we get down to the roots. You can, this, the example of the idea of the roots is that you can pluck the leaves off a tree, and the tree will just grow more leaves. But if you pull out the root of the tree, the taproot or something, then the tree won't, you know, will die. So if you just take off, if you have hate, for example, aversion, anger, you might be able to let go of individual pieces of anger, you know. But if the root of the anger tree is still there, it'll sprout more leaves. And so you have to have some way to get down into the root to really understand what's really going on in a deep, deep way that gives rise to hate in the beginning with, or gives rise to fear, or gives rise to a strong attachment to self, or strong attachment to anything. And so retreat is a place where this can happen. And then, you don't want to get attached to retreats. Because you might have to go to Bangkok. And I think what's really important part of our tradition of practice is the idea of going back and forth. The idea that there's a rhythm of meditating and entering into your life. Going on retreats and then going into your life. And that going back and forth. And each place, they complement each other. And if you're not tested or challenged, when you go and meditate, just you drop into deep peace. We're all happy for you. But then you get to go back into your life. Work, family, whatever. You know, holidays are coming up, right? And so you get tested. And then, but then if that's all going really well for you, for whatever reason, then you go on retreat. And you find out what's really going on, maybe. And this going back and forth, they both complement each other beautifully. And slowly over time, at least I've discovered, this really, really rich experience of delving into, you know, what I wasn't aware of in the past, but now I am aware of. And as I've done that, become more and more aware, my ability to suffer, or my tendency to suffer, has decreased dramatically. So, you know, much more peace and happiness than when I was so unaware in the past. So, what are you not aware of? So if I may, I'll tell you a story. And then we'll stop. From my new little book that I have called The Monastery Within. There was a really wise old nun who had, in her old age, had retired to a little hermitage deep, deep in the woods, in the mountains, high up in the mountains. 3-day hike from civilization. And she was renownedly famous for giving really good spiritual advice to people. People would come from all over the world, and they'd do that 3-day trek into the mountains to tell her about their life and their problems, and she would listen very attentively, and then she'd give this beautiful advice. And she'd give advice. But before she gave the advice, she'd always tell the person who came to her, she would say, "Yeah, I'll give you, you know, advice, teaching, but you have to promise not to tell anyone." That was the condition. And the reason why she had that condition was she always gave everybody the same advice. And usually when people first heard this advice, they said, "What's this?" They kind of like dismissed it. "That's not important. Well, that's not for me," or something. They couldn't understand it. But it took 3 days to hike out of the mountains. And by the time they hiked out, it took 3 days, they would come out and they'd say, "She had just the right thing for me. I can't believe how perceptive she was. She knew exactly what to tell me." So it's a secret, right? It's kind of. So the advice that she gave was, or what the teaching she gave, the instruction she gave was, "What are you not paying attention to?" So So I'll give you 3 days. What are you not paying attention to? So enjoy. Thank you.